In this week's show, we discuss the latest program from MythVision, a podcast that appears on YouTube, dedicated to discuss the Bible and debunk a lot of Christian beliefs. The video is called Yahweh, God Takes No Pity, a MythVision documentary. The host of this show, David Daniel Gonzalez, started a debate with the MythVision followers on the Facebook page in challenging the host of the show to be on our radio program because there are a lot of ongoing issues that are discussed in his programs that we would like to pursue and get some clarity on, especially where he's coming from. My co-host Tony and I decided to take on his full documentary and do commentary. We hope that it won't be too much of a challenge to follow, but we would like to see what our audience thinks about our commentary. Thank you. Welcome to another episode of Raiders of the Unknown. I've been starting conflict online, trying to respond to this video that we're going to be critiquing. Look, I appreciate the creator of the video for taking the time to do it. If I had time and the technology, I might do something similar. I might even do it as a mock documentary, or as like today we were watching this video where someone was making fun of Bible verses. I would actually, to get a point across, I would actually question and even like take it to the extreme of like, is it really God? Is it just our imagination? Is it a Canaanite deity that is being portrayed in a different way, or the hodgepodge of different deities? I have no problem of doing that as a question, doing it as intellectual exercise. But when you do it as the gospel, that's when we're going to talk. And the thing that we critiqued last time, the parallel mania that is usually depicted in MythVision, I think is going to come to the forefront. So I was telling Tony, my co-host, before we started the show, that we're not making any profit out of critiquing Derek's work. We're not doing it in a malicious intent to try to cause problems for him and his family and his projects. We're doing it because we want to discuss the ideas. So this is not ripping his material or trying to do anything that causes harm. We're trying to address the issues that he brings up. And as ridiculous as it sounds, when you go after the deity of 2/3 of the population of the world, you should expect some response. If I came after Taylor Swift, all the Swifties would come after me. So all the God-fearing, Bible thumpers like Tony and I are going to say something, but we're going to say it in the most generous and most loving way, because again, they're just ideas. If you're not comfortable enough with people questioning your views, then there's something wrong with you. So I appreciate atheists and free thinkers out there, because they are courageous enough to bring these issues to the forefront, but we can challenge it just like they can challenge us, and they can challenge these eternal ideas that some of us find very important. Tony, do you have any comments before we start the critique and conversation about this 2-hour long project?
I'm just interested to see the basis of what's being said here.
Okay, so but get ready for some very graphic images. I know it's all AI, but it just the contrast of the different found images from all the online stuff. I was telling Tony that most likely he typed demonic entity from Canaanite and Israelite sources, trying to overcome the world, and this like horrible demon came up. So I give it to him for trying to be controversial. So let's get started.
The violent storm god Yahweh takes no pity. In the depths of ancient history, a storm deity reigned with unparalleled power, or so it would seem, to those putting the Bible on a pedestal. Today, we invite you on an extraordinary journey into the realm of Yahweh, the storm god who shows no mercy to his enemies. Yes, we will show you the destructive behavior of this deity, but is he alone in his conquest? No. Did the biblical events even happen? Were there other kings and gods who did similar things to other nations in the same way that Yahweh commands Israel to do to the Canaanites, Amalekites, or any other ites? For many, this documentary will be shocking because it shines a light into the dark nature of the biblical deity. For other,
What do you think? I want to again congratulate Mr. Lambert for being fair. You know, we see these things in the History Channel where they say, you know, the God of the Israelites was a wicked God that slaughtered thousands. And then you start thinking, well, what about the Roman gods? What about the Visigoth gods? Every group back then felt that whenever they won a battle, that was because their deity helped them. So if you project back after you fight a battle with whatever enemy and you say, the Lord delivered them to my hands, that is a common practice of all tribes and all groups of people throughout history. To single out the Israelites, Hebrews, or Jews as cruel, demonic, aggressive and violent is what I would cry foul about, because of course there's ramifications in saying that. If you say those evil Mayans, those evil Aztecs, there's no more Mayans and no more Aztecs per se. The Mayan population is still around, but they're not an organized group like back then. But if you say those evil Jews, those evil Israelite Hebrews or whatever, then you're plaguing us with the curse of Cain and all the stuff that we've been going through for thousands of years. What do you think, Tony? In the first 54 seconds, what do you see, and does it stir up any feelings for you?
I think he's got a lot of convolution. He's got a lot of things mixed together. I've seen these arguments within scholarly and academia, and it appears sometimes that they take these deities and they mix them together because of the sim their similarities, but they're still he's already starting off on the wrong foot.
Okay, we're gonna keep on checking it out.
Well aware of these issues, you will value the depth of scholarly observations. We will also cover many of the apologetic responses to these biblical events, showing you how none of their arguments stand up to the problem. More importantly, MythVision hopes this documentary helps one see the human fingerprint in the construction of the biblical narrative. The description of this deity seems all too human and dated to the period in history when other kings and gods were doing the same to their enemies. Someone in the back may shout, "That's the Old Testament, and we live in the New Testament age. Jesus would never promote this kind of destruction." We will cover apocalyptic violence in the New Testament. Suffice to say,
Praise God. Finally, somebody does what I've been wanting someone to do for ages, is depict the deity that is described in the New Testament as the same deity as described in the Old Testament. If you don't, then you are some type of Gnostic lunatic who's trying to make a distinction between the Israelite God as described in the New Testament, which it was the sectarian group of the Jesus movement. Was pointing back to everything that it was described by God and his prophets in the Tanakh or Hebrew scriptures. If it doesn't point to that, then it is some type of Greco-Roman cult that was just nitpicking the stuff that they like. So, as my friend John Dominic Crossan would say, it's the same God throughout the whole thing, and he is violent in some ways, but he's also not to the extreme that people would want to judge him in our modern eyes. And again, violence is only wicked or evil or cruel when it's being done with no purpose or no aspect. Like, this is the problem, and we're gonna discuss this all along. If you say it's violent to kill an animal, you are making an absolutist statement. Because it's violent to kill an animal, of course, it's violent to kill anything. But if you kill an animal to eat them, is that true violence and destructive and cruel? Or if you kill an animal who's trying to bite you, is that violent, cruel, and evil? So to make these broad statements, such as the God of the Old Testament was mean, or the God or the deity that became Jesus in the New Testament was hateful, that's a very even aggressive on our part judgment. You become suddenly the judge over these major concepts, and you are demeaning them to make a point. So now you are the arbiter of what's right and wrong. And unless we know you very well as a super righteous, wonderful person, we don't know where you're getting your morality from and where are you heading with this information. So if you're going to be a complete pacifist, then the Bible is not your book. What do you think, Tony?
Well, I do appreciate the fact that he linked the God of Old Testament and New Testament. He put a picture I would assume would be so-called Jesus on the screen when he mentioned God. I think that's a problem, but you brought some valid points up, and I would like to add on the fact that it's easy to look in the way that humanity has evolved over time, and we've progressed morally and ethically in the modern state of the world. You go back thousands of years back, you have mankind more in a primitive state. I mean, people are still sacrificing human beings to their deities. You've got all kinds of things that we can't even imagine or fathom that were happening on a day-to-day basis. So it's easy to look back in hindsight and look back at those of the past and try to paint them in a bad light. But I don't think it's fair, and it's not giving them a fair shot of what's going on. And you want to talk about, is it violence or is it justice? It's all about the perception. I think he's looking at it with the wrong lens, and he's looking at trying to find fault instead of trying to understand the whole narrative of what's truly going on, what the Bible is trying to convey to us. So,
Well, let's keep watching and see where it's heading.
the New Testament arguably is worse in nature than the Old Testament. I will let you be the judge. So tell me what you think in the comments.
I want to give another shout out to Mr. Lambert for being a pro-Jewish, because that's the new tactic from the atheist movement and all scholars, even Christian scholars, is to say, I'm not coming after the Jews. I'm not coming after the Hebrew scriptures. I'm coming against Christianity, which is worse than the Jews. And my favorite heretic is Mr. Nietzsche, who started off with Christianity's crap and then moved on to the Jews as the reason that Christianity's crap, because they're emulating the Jewish God. So now, because it's not politically correct to attack the Jews directly, you have to attack the Christians and then roundabout attack the God of the Bible, which is the Jewish version of God. So the common practice is to not be so overly insensitive to Jewish issues in relation to trashing our scriptures, but you want to trash your scriptures. So my biggest issue is, why can't you just leave it alone? If you don't like the God of the Bible, why can't you just let it be? Go start your own religion. Go move on to whatever place where they don't persecute atheists, Switzerland or whatever. Like, I don't want to do love it or leave it, but as a minority, a member of minority religion, I have to put up with a lot of criticism, a lot of ignorance, stuff like that. And it makes me feel proud that I haven't given in to their biases. I wish that the atheist community would have that and would not spend all their time trying to trash something they don't appreciate.
Yeah, it's very odd that he chooses to. I'm not familiar too familiar with MythVision. That does he do hit pieces on other gods and other religions? Like, has he made one for Islam and?
I saw one about the Hindus, and then everything else is the Bible, the Bible, the Bible, the Bible. The Bible is the same as the Odyssey. The Bible is the same as the life of Heracles or Hercules. The Bible, the Bible, the Bible, the Bible. Like, I used to love studying different religions. When I was a kid, I knew everything about the Hindu deities. I knew everything about the Buddha. I knew everything about tribal stuff. Like, I would love to hear the latest on what's going on. Did we find out that the gods of the Hopi people in Native Americans, that they were actually aliens, and that's why they look so funky?
This video is based off the excellent book by Dr. Joshua Bowen called The Atheist Handbook to the Old Testament, Volume 2.
Hold up. He's always pulling these old books that I don't know where he gets from. I guess there's now, like, you know how Mickey Mouse became public commons? Like, I am a big fan of oldies but goodies. Like, there's a lot of good stuff. Like, we did a recording about the Passover plot, and it had stuff that I hadn't seen in the more modern stuff. But there's also the fear that a lot of these old comments and perspectives do not have the latest information. So one thing that I'm gonna prophesy is gonna happen in this video is that he's gonna make a lot of the common mistakes that even Jews who try to anti-missionize the Christians, or Christians who try to spread pretty much propaganda, make is that they give you versions of the what it really is their rhetoric is not up to speed with what's going on. So, we can talk about the New Testament from all kinds of different perspectives, but if you look at the latest information, kind of like what Mr. Lambert does with some of his guests, there's things that have been brought up that back in the day might not be considered, especially with new developments in archaeology, anthropology, and things like that. So let's see if in this video, maybe not in the other videos, but in this video, he makes common mistakes that are made from people who are amateurish when it comes down to discussing the Bible. Because the Bible is a very complex book, there's a lot of layers, there's a lot of different fields that you can study it from. And if you study it specifically to debunk it, then you're going to fall into some type of premises that are not verifiable, because it's almost like your opinion against the world. And that's one of the things that I brought up, and his followers don't seem to see it.
Be sure to grab a copy in the description. It comes in hardcover, paperback, or on Audible for you to listen to. I swear this book is loaded with great insights, and he sources all the arguments he makes for you to be able to check or fact check what he says. Subscribe to our channel to not miss out on any part of this epic journey.
Again, we don't want to be nitpicky, but I see a lot of different deities all over the place. And when we got cut off earlier, I was saying that I haven't seen anything about the Egyptian gods. I think I saw something about the Hindu gods. I haven't seen anything about the Roman gods other than in comparison to the Israelite one, and the stories. So, there's a lot of really cool stuff. It almost seems like a video game when you look at the images.
Part of this incredible exploration. This is more than a documentary. It's a journey into the heart of a storm. Welcome to the world of Yahweh, the storm deity who takes no pity. Let the adventure begin.
Who calls him Yahweh?
Introduction. They had been waiting for this moment for years. He and his wife had been longing for, dreaming for, a son. And it had finally happened. The boy was everything that a father could ask for. Life could not have been better. Then came that fateful day. Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah to offer him up there as a whole burnt offering upon one of the mountains, which I will tell you. Genesis 22:2. How could God tell this man to kill the son he had waited for all these years? This is, of course, the dilemma in one of the most famous stories from the book of Genesis, what Jews refer to as the Akedah, the binding, Abraham's sacrifice of his son Isaac. Dr. William Deaver summarizes the problem with this passage well.
One story about Abraham is difficult to rationalize on any grounds because it appears to impugn the motives of both Abraham and Yahweh. That is the famous story of Yahweh's command. That Abraham sacrificed his beloved son Isaac, the miracle child, as a bloody offering. The biblical rationale, of course, is that God was only testing Abraham's faith and unquestioned loyalty. But what kind of God would do such a thing? And what kind of father would willingly comply?
The violence that appears throughout the pages of the Hebrew Bible has presented no small problem for people who wish to build their ethical systems upon or derive their value.
Okay, well, that's a low blow. So we didn't even talk about any other story in the Genesis account. We didn't talk about merciful, nurturing creator who gave humanity life. We didn't talk about how humans had willpower and the ability to question that God and go against him. We didn't talk about how the serpent it could be seen as the, the either, personification of evil, but also personification of free will and independence from the creator. And then the stories about how God does not like murder, because if he liked murder, then he would have given Cain a present instead of marking him for life as a criminal. How God doesn't like violence and hatred, because if that, he wouldn't have destroyed the earth and all of its inhabitants because they were misbehaving. So you mentioned that, justice is different than violence, because now you have some type of moral code that is being violated, and that's what this deity has a problem with. If you just jump from zero to Abraham killing his son, of course he's a cruel God, because it makes no sense. If you started hearing voices in your head and they told you to murder your family, you would be a horrible person. But nowhere in this conversation have we talked about how it was a common practice to sacrifice your children to appease the deities of that time. So when you look at the story of Abraham and Isaac, which he mispronounces, the Akedah is the Islamic version, is the Akedah is the Jewish or Hebrew version. It is turning a common practice on its head. It's saying that you can get so close to paganism that paganism is thwarted, and that you realize that it's not about sacrificing your family, but it's about trusting God. For ancient people, 5,000 or whatever, 4,000 years ago, to realize that, to put it on paper, and to find a very subtle way to critique human sacrifice, That's what the story is about. It's not about some wacko listening to some crazy deity to murder their child, which some Christians might want you to believe. It was about a faithful descendant of the Sumerians who broke off from them and became, some type of visionary of what religion should be like. And religion becomes a way of serving a greater purpose and a greater power, and that power puts limitations on your idiotic ways of wanting to please him. Because it's common for humans to want to do something to change their environment. That is the basis of paganism. Paganism says that you can control other people and yourself by manipulating nature. In this situation, you have someone who gets to the cusp of that and then somehow realizes, either through divine fiat or through their own wisdom, that that's not the proper way to serve this force. And then it becomes a narrative that affects the life of thousands of people throughout history, that our faith should be similar to the pagans. We should be willing to sacrifice everything, but you shouldn't turn to murder as the form of expressing that love or that affection for that idea. What do you think, Tony?
Yeah, I don't think he jumped leaps and bounds, completely missed the whole buildup of the narrative. And he obviously he's cherry picking what he wants to bring into the mix as far as what he wants to attack God from his perspective. And so he just jumps right into Abraham and Yitzhak on the mountain. And it's really funny because, like you said, this is a common practice that was going on at the time. And he didn't mention anything about, Abraham being Abram, and then he got called out from his fathers to leave his fathers. And then you have also the Agadah surrounding it, or the Midrash that goes into his fathers were they were idolaters, and he questioned his fathers for what they were doing. And it's just it's not giving, it's not painting the picture properly. He's painting with broad strokes, and it's not fair to the narrative. And he's already off. I mean, you can already tell. And then the person he mentioned, Dr. William Dever, I think he's an atheist. I think he's an atheist now. He started off as a Christian, then converted to Reformed Judaism, and then now he's an atheist. I see this a lot in academia. There's people that will study the Bible, and they get so caught up in things having to fit within the narrative the way they were taught. And if something gets brought up that's different than their idea, sometimes they'll just throw it out as if it's not valid, or they'll completely become atheist. And I think people are sometimes when people do that, I think they're looking for a reason not to not believe in God. And if that's what they want, then that's what God will give you. He's not looking for people to force to worship him. But so far he's working. He's not doing this thorough. He's not being thorough.
Well, and we're not gonna blame the host. We're gonna blame this book. And again,
Yeah.
you can start attacking head on, and we're gonna respond head on, because we can all say that the Akedah is the most difficult passage in the Bible. But when it comes down to, I even forgot about the Tower of Babel. I even forgot about all these other issues that happened before this. And they were all issues that the people were grappling with. So instead of thinking of divine revelation, think about it as human beings struggling with existence. So human beings look at how did we come about, and their version of how we came about was a very wise and special a conversation to have about the role of men, the role of women, the role of wisdom, the role of disobedience. Is there a creator? How would the creator express his will to us? And then if all that is true, then are children accountable? And the way they hurt each other is a problem. And then when people work together as a team to try to challenge nature or the cosmos, it blows up in their faces. And then you have this one individual who breaks off from a very destructive and you know, bondage type of religious system that it was already created early on, and looks for something that it is more encompassing and able to follow certain principles that are special and unique to his perspective. Like, I can't wait for them to start pointing back to other religions and how all that influenced Abrahamic faith. But as we've discussed before, there's a uniqueness of the message of this Chaldean guy who created this monotheistic system that you can say is mythological, legend, or whatever, but it's still very powerful. And we read it, and it still has an impact, even, you know, these 4,000 years later. So let's see what else they're saying about Abraham and how we all are struggle with this violent deity that just shows up and starts killing everybody.
From this sacred text, while philosophical issues like the problem of evil are discussed and debated in relation to theism, the problem becomes exponentially greater when the deity not only allows, but also commands what we would consider to be evil actions. The ethical difficulties with many biblical passages and the theological concepts they engender often become obvious when sincere believers attempt to convince unbelievers of the goodness and love of God.
Okay, well, I don't want to convince anybody, but I want to get one information clear. If you believe in rainbows and butterflies, again, this book is not for you, because what the author of this book is doing is the same thing that there was a guy that I ran into. He wrote a book called Conversations with God. And in an interview that he did on a radio show, he was saying that the God of the Bible is a violent God and that we need to create our own God. But he said something that it was the most ridiculous thing I ever heard in my life. He said, if you count the amount of people that God has destroyed through the Israelite or Hebrew kingdom or whatever, the 12 tribes or whomever, all together throughout the whole Bible, it was like 1 million people or 1 billion people or something like that. That is atrocious. And if you really think about it, millions and billions and, you know, but millions of people die all day long, every day, throughout history. So if you impose that responsibility on a creator, of course he's a murderer, but he's also a creator. So you can't say, I don't like this deity that is portrayed in the Bible because he kills, when we all see death all day long. We can talk about using people to bring about destruction and slaughter of whomever. But if you're going to make a blanket statement that it's evil to kill, or it's evil for people to die unjustly, then you really have a problem with nature. You have a problem with reality. And now you're imposing that problem on this fictional character that you don't even believe in. So now, if they did that, they were foolish for it, but you're a fool because you're going with them. You're saying that some imaginary friend is culpable for the death of all humanity throughout history, and that he uses people to bring it about too, when that's also another form of paganism. Paganism gives death personification, and now the agent of death is God. So you're creating your own enemy out of thin air, and you're imposing that on a deity that has both characteristics, the characteristic of giving life and the characteristic of taking it away. So they don't see that. All they see that is how cruel is existence? Why pin it on this vision of God?
Apart from these interactions, it seems quite common for many semi-regular church attendees to receive some form of indoctrination as a means of addressing God's commands of violence in the Old Testament. As we will come to see in this documentary, believers are trained, both from the text and the pulpit, to resolve the problem of human suffering at the hands of Yahweh in one or both of the following ways. Victims of divine violence, one, were completely deserving of God's wrath and judgment, and or two, did not suffer in the way we think, as the text frequently contains culturally appropriate hyperbolic exaggerations. Dr. Hector Avalos explains it in this way.
Scholarship on the violence in the Hebrew Bible has been marked by at least two positions. The first position views the violence as historically accurate and morally defensible. A second position denies that the violence actually occurred or minimizes its importance. For example, the violence could have a purely literary or rhetorical function.
For believers, these conscious or unconscious apologetic approaches to the violent commands in the Hebrew Bible are, in my experience, not only incredibly effective, but generally emotionally satisfying. If the text is not being hyperbolic, for example, then one can rest assured that God had a morally justified reason for his pronouncements of violent judgment. In fact, we will see that many of these narratives hinge upon the implementation of violence, particularly requiring it to be all pervasive and total in its execution. In some cases, more than I would like to think, believers are not only emotionally and intellectually satisfied by these apologetic arguments, but they are actually emboldened and even excited about God's violent behavior in both the Old and New Testaments. Much to my dismay, I am sometimes forced to interact with individuals online who actually take pleasure in the prospect of being able to put their foot on the throats of their unbelieving enemies sometime in the near future.
Just you wait.
I will sometimes hear,
"You won't doubt God is real when he gives us a sword to come and destroy you."
It is true that relatively few are so enchanted by their beliefs in an impending day of judgment in which they will be given power over their perceived enemies. However, I do not think that, on a deeper level, this is an uncommon form of comfort and consolation to believers who feel themselves persecuted by their society and culture. We will return to this mentality and its connection to the Old and New Testaments.
Tony, if I came to you and I said all atheists are cult members, they worship themselves, and you must fear them because as they've been mistreated, tortured, set on fire, whatever, the Inquisition or the Protestants, the Catholics, the Muslims, even the Buddhists have some heretic hunting going on. Now it's payback time. Now they're going to turn on all the people that hurt them and they're going to kill us all. How would you react?
If you came to me and told me that all atheists were coming to kill me, I would laugh.
Well, that's what this guy is saying about Christians. He's saying that Christians who have interacted with him are saying, "Wait until the horseman comes with the sword, and I'm going to grab his sword and come get you." Portraying a whole group of people as fanatical murderers is such a low blow that it's like in Batman, Dark Knight, where the Joker tells Batman, "You can't punch me in the face and then ask me questions. I'm gonna be kind of blurry about it." Like, this guy is preaching to the choir, I guess, because any religious person who's watching this, they've already been turned off by being told that we take pleasure and we get excited when we think about God's justice on our enemies. And what he doesn't understand is that it is a common a feeling of all humans to feel satisfaction when justice is served. John Oliver, I was watching a video about his views on the death penalty before the show. And he was saying that it was immoral, it was inappropriate, it was scientifically, not a good deal, and all this stuff. But the issue goes back to when a bad guy robs you and they catch him, you find some sense of satisfaction knowing that what you lost is being returned to you. I can see someone saying if you murder a murderer, that doesn't give you back the person they killed, but it might give you some sense of satisfaction that this person is not out there hurting other people. So to assume any type of violence is evil is the problem with this video. We're back to you're not supposed to defend yourself. You're not supposed to kill an animal who bites you. You're not supposed to do anything because we've already made a decision and we created a straw man that any form of violence is evil. So the same judgmental crap that atheists have experienced throughout history now is being put on the Christians. And so that's the psychological problem. I usually don't talk about psychology. I'm not a psychologist and I don't feel comfortable or I think that it's appropriate. Most people talk about psychological terms and using pop psychology and they're abusing it. But to use the same stigma that they have on atheists and turn it around and put it against believers of any group, it's a hateful act. So now if we're going to use these very strong terms, now I can say, you call it evil, I call it hateful. To depict a group of people as willful participants in God's vengeance or murderers in waiting for the time they get to destroy all atheists is uncalled for and unnecessary. If you have an issue with the religious views of these cats, just focus on that. Don't focus on their character as people, because then we're gonna start doing the competition game where how many atheists kill how many people in communist Russia, and how many Christians have killed heretics in the last 2,000 years. And I'm sure that the Christian kingdoms would lose, but that's not the way to approach these fundamental issues.
In this documentary, I would like to address the problem of divine violence and genocide in the Hebrew Bible from a few different angles. First, we will examine the nature of Yahweh's vengeance that is encapsulated in the crucial Hebrew word harem, or the ban. Exactly what this word means and how it is used is essential for understanding divine violence in the Old Testament. Following that, we will establish what the Old Testament has to say more explicitly about violence, particularly when presented in the form of direct commands given by God. At the same time, we need to determine what the original authors most likely meant when they penned these violent passages, over and above what later theological interpretations would suggest. Relevant passages from the Old Testament will be discussed, including clear examples of such problematic texts that contain commands about the conquest of the land of Canaan and the wholesale slaughter of the Amalekites. We will then address and evaluate common apologetic responses to these difficult passages in the Old Testament using.
He's talking about apologetics. Again, Christians are not the problem. Apologetics is a term coined by Christians about trying to prove something to someone. You're not fighting apologetics. You were fighting the text. And you notice he said the Hebrew Bible. So now we're talking about the tradition passed down through the generations from the Hebrews who became the Israelites, who became the Jews, to us now. So again, it's the sacred text of one particular group now is going to be criticized, nitpicked, focused on, because a secondary group who developed from it, the Christians, have disseminated it and pushed it down people's throats. And now it's your job as an atheist to dismiss and dispel all these random stories from this one particular group. Thanks a lot, man. We really appreciate being put on the burner at such a time as this. They got mad at me for saying that at the Facebook group, but it's like, this is not the time to start picking on our sacred scriptures because it has consequences. What do you think, Tony?
Yeah, he's not being fair at all. He's making low blows. He made that little hit in there, and he knows this. He's a content creator from YouTube. He knows that social media and these media platforms are a cesspool of people running their mouths, saying what they want. There's no accountability for these people, and you can't just say that that's how all people are, all Christians are. That is not true. And this kind of, so far, it feels like his terminology and the way he's approaching it is from one perspective, one interpretation, which is the Christian view. He's using Jewish terms like Hebrew Bible, but he's really emphasizing a lot to deal with a Christian interpretation, Christian view. So yeah, it's not, he's not giving it a fair t he's not giving it a fair shot, first off. So I expect what you said you were going to prophesy. I'm starting to see the build up to what's about to be said. So,
The internal logic of the narratives and comparisons with similar ancient Near Eastern texts that likewise contain violent divine commands. The first apologetic defense is to point out the supposed absolute wickedness of the victims of God's violent behavior. Don't you know that these people were offering their own babies on a burning altar to Molech? They were the most wicked and violent people imaginable. God had to wipe them out. The most obvious problem with this approach will become clear almost immediately upon investigation. But suffice it to say, it requires a particular presupposition or predetermined conclusion regarding the fidelity of the Old Testament texts. However, even assuming that these victims were wicked, we will see that the apologist must be willing to not only defend Yahweh's actions based on this metric, but also the acts of the other gods in the ancient Near East. It is also quite common to hear, "It's all hyperbole." Some of the language used in the text we will examine appears to be hyperbolic. When responding to criticisms of the celebration of violence in the Bible, you have probably heard someone say,
"We even do this today. Boy, the Steelers slaughtered the Vikings in the game on Sunday." We obviously don't mean that one football team actually killed the other.
It is argued, therefore, that since someone of the language in the biblical texts likely contains some level of exaggeration or hyperbole in what it reports, this resolves the issue. Spoilers, it does not. It will also be important to examine the genre of apocalypticism in the context of divine violence, as there is a direct connection between the apocalyptic mentality and vivid descriptions of anticipated divine violence and retribution. Apocalypticism is more properly a type of worldview that began to develop in the Persian and Hellenistic periods, circa 400 to 150 BCE. Aspects of it are evident within the Hebrew Bible, particularly in the book of Daniel, and it became quite pervasive in the books of the New Testament, perhaps especially in Revelation. While we will not spend a great deal of time in the New Testament, it is important to recognize the part that apocalypticism played in developing a violent mindset, as cosmic good will, in fact, must ultimately overcome evil, inevitably through violence. Finally, I would like to spend a bit of time engaging with how these violent passages and ideas affect us today as modern readers. This will have less to do with what the text actually meant in its original context, and more to do with the effect that the divine violence in the Bible has had on the way adherents understand and interact with these theological ideas. Can violence and its use in the Bible have a subtle but dangerous effect on the modern reader, both in what they believe and in how they behave? The ban.
This guy's jumping all over the place. He builds up, he's building up an idea, saying it's going to be, I'm about to show you, it's going to be crystal clear. And then he jumps to a mystical apocalyptic things. He's all over the place. You really can't. If you're going to make a point, make a point. If you're going to make something crystal clear, I mean, because what he's saying, the way he's using his, theatrics with his voice, and he's building up things and these dynamics. I should be a murderer. I serve the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I don't mean Jesus. I mean the God of the Jewish people. Why am I not a murderer? Why am I not a rapist? Why am I not sacrificing my children? Why am I against those things? If my God is so murderous and so evil, why am I not murderous and vicious like him since he's my father, right? I just don't understand his point. He's jumping over,
Well,
he's making accusations and he doesn't prove his point. I'm still waiting for him to make a point. He hasn't made one yet.
he's doing that Family Guy thing where you're starting a story and then they jump to a joke and then they come back to the story. But it's a great point that you make. If Jews or God-fearers or whatever they want to call people who follow the God of Israel, the ancient deity of the Hebrews, do not behave in those ways, then where does this come from? And the ethics and the morality of our people come from a counter argument that is described throughout the whole of scripture against the practices of others. So you can say that the winner wrote the book and that we slaughter everyone and then we painted them in a bad light. That's what happened in Christianity, where all the heretics were the people that the church fathers didn't like. But in the instance of these people who wrote this text, they were the underdog. They were the ones who were under the oppression of the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, and the Greeks. So for them to say, we won, or we, took them out, or something like that, but we don't believe what they believe. We need to incorporate their ideas into ours. We actually have a higher ethic that involves love for humanity and respect for one another and interest in the well-being of even the captive and giving rights to groups that are now even mistreated. Like all these things that have come across throughout history are things that come from this type of ethical monotheism that he's trying to trash. So, like you said, if the deity that we follow encourages us to be wicked, then we would be the wickedest of them all because we have the biggest mandate. We have the God of the universe on our side. So how can we not take advantage of that? But the God of the universe, he showed the Ten Commandments and he said that the Ten Commandments were murderous. The Ten Commandments are the foundation of a ethical, moral and virtuous life. And they put guidelines over human temptation and human desire to take on as much power, as much sexual gratification, as much ability to control others. And like seven of them tell you that you need to hone in on your passions. What kind of crazy system, based on a wild and evil character, would ask you to moderate your behavior? So you have a great point there.
And Yahweh our God also delivered into our hand Og king of Bashan and all his people. And we struck him down until there was not a single survivor remaining. And we captured all his cities at that time. There was not a city that we did not take from them. 60 cities, all the region of Argob, the kingdom of Og of Bashan. All these cities were impregnable, high walls, gates, and bars, besides very many rural cities. And we completely destroyed them, just as we did to Sihon, king of Heshbon, completely destroying every city, men, the women, and the small children. Deuteronomy 3:3-6.
Pretty strong language, the phrase that is translated, you must absolutely destroy them in verse 2, and completely destroy in verse 6, stems from a verbal root that is used in the word harem, which is most literally translated the ban. This word shows up in several different violent and problematic contexts. But what is harem? What does it mean to be under the ban in the Old Testament? We need to establish what is meant by dedicating someone or something to total destruction or to the ban. as it will come into play in much of the following discussion. Let's begin by looking at the meaning associated with the verb and noun forms of the word. As a verb, the root term normally carries the meaning to put under the ban. Super helpful, huh? More basically, it has the idea of separating, setting something apart, or dedicating something for someone's use or purposes. Once dedicated, it is no longer available for use by others. In the Hebrew Bible, this type of dedication is made almost exclusively to Yahweh. Because Hebrew is a Semitic language, we can look at other Semitic languages and see if they also have a form of this word and if it is used in a similar way. This root appears, for example, in Akkadian. The verb haramnu can be found in lexical lists with the Sumerian word to cut, separate. The noun is essentially the same, something that is set apart or dedicated to something for their use. It may be that the Akkadian word for prostitute, harimtu, is related to the same root with the idea of being set apart or dedicated to the activity. In both languages, Hebrew and Akkadian, the root haram seems to carry similar meanings, as it refers to things that are separated out or set apart for a particular use or activity. Returning to the Old Testament, we encounter primarily two contexts in which these words occur. Less frequently when something, someone, is dedicated to Yahweh for cultic use, but more commonly when something, someone is dedicated to Yahweh for destruction. Dr. Rossell explains.
The idea of the ban developed in two different directions. One possibility was the concentration on the sacred object. The ban became an extreme form of consecration. The object was not destroyed or killed, but transferred to God, actually to his priests, for holy use. On the other hand, the aspect of the sacred could fade completely, and ban assumed the meaning of complete extermination, mostly as a result of wars.
While the cultic occurrences are important to the discussion in general, for our purposes in this video, we will dedicate ourselves, I'm so funny, to investigating the destruction passages in the context of war. There are several passages that demonstrate this particular use of the word harem or harem, but I will mention just two here. We will revisit them in greater detail later. The first is in Deuteronomy 2, where Moses is recounting the Israelites' defeat of Sihon, king of Heshbon, in Transjordan. In verses 33 through 34, we read,
"And Yahweh our God handed him over to us, and we struck him and his sons and all his people, and we captured all his cities at that time. And we completely destroyed Aram, every city, the men, women, and the small children. We did not leave a single survivor." Deuteronomy 2, 33 to 34.
Here, the text details what it meant for the city to be dedicated to the ban. They were to leave no survivors, down to the men, women, and children. Dr. Dozman writes,
Deuteronomy 2, 34 illustrates, "When Moses describes the nature of the defeat of Sihon as utterly destroying men, women, and children, he concludes, 'We left not a single survivor.' See also Deut 3:6, 13:16, 20:17. The ban is violated if Israel makes a covenant with a nation and thus shows mercy."
Similarly, in 1 Samuel 15, a story that we have discussed on several occasions now, we see Yahweh commanding Saul to take military action against an old enemy, the Amalekites.
"Thus says Yahweh of hosts, I have taken account of all that Amalek did to Israel when he ambushed him in the road when he went up from Egypt. Now go, strike Amalek, and completely destroy Aram, all that he has, and do not have pity on him. But put to death everyone from man to woman, from child to infant, from bull to lamb, from camel to donkey." 1 Samuel 15, 2, 3.
So for those that are not familiar with Jewish interpretation, this is where it's important to have some type of, the term would be mitigation. So you take a passage, there's all kinds of passages and dash the babies of my enemies against the rocks or something horrible like that. And then you say, okay, did this guy actually mean that, or was there something more behind it? And what Judaism does is that it mitigates poor reading of a text. And this is something that I've tried to do with Christian authors and theologians, where they can mitigate the hateful passages in the New Testament against the Jews. And you can say, well, that's a cop out, to try to reinterpret or expand or open up the passage so it is not as vile and hateful. It's is something that he kind of alluded to, that Christians will try to find metaphorical ways to get out of these moral constraints, moral dilemmas. But what's important is that you have to compare views that are described in these texts to each other. And this, as much as the most religious folks will not agree with the documentary hypotheses, it's important to have that in the rearview mirror, because you can have one group that says, make deals with all the groups in Canaan, and you have another writer who says, no, slaughter them all. And you can say, well, God now is schizophrenic, because you have one God that says, I love all humanity and they're all my children. And then you have another one that says, there are certain people that need to go. When a passage doesn't make sense, or it seems cruel or out of fashion with the way that God is portrayed, that's when the rabbis, the scholars, even the modern day interpreters can work with it. Because again, we're talking about divine knowledge or divine revelation, which is not a wooden thing. Like, if I tell my, like, and this is the example that Derek used. If I tell my child, I slaughtered this cake, does it mean that I killed the cake, or does it mean that I ate it? So he's using this term haram, which in Islamic culture means you put a haram against your enemies, and you get all the troops to get them. And in Jewish law, harem is an excommunication, putting someone out of the community because of misbehavior. So this is a very loaded term. And it comes from dedicating something. You have to think of, well, when God dedicates something, what is the purpose behind it? But you also have to look at anthropology and understand that in every culture, there was things that were dedicated to the deity, and there was things that were forbidden, and there were things that were, taboo, and you weren't allowed to participate in. So if the context of all these passages is there's a group of people who are causing harm, and they're bringing about the destruction or the corruption of the group, which the group has a special calling, they feel justified to use a kind of language of destruction to save the community. So I don't know if in the case of leprosy or whatever a term it was used, that there was such a haram against it that you would burn down the house or bury the stuff so then it wouldn't spread with the people. That's how they treated wickedness. They treated what they considered wickedness as a disease that needed to be extirpated or destroyed so it wouldn't spread. And then there's a rabbinic discussion where they say, God forbid that the innocent would die with the guilty. God forbid that the children would pay for the sins of the father, because in a previous passage, it said that God doesn't do that. So how can God say in somewhere in Exodus or Deuteronomy that the sins of the fathers will never go to the children? And then when they come into a situation where they feel threatened or they're scared or they're fighting somebody, that suddenly everybody pays and everybody dies, which in modern terms, and this is why this is so dangerous, now we're talking about corporate penalties or, genocide or however they want to extirpate it and put it in modern day situations. So one rabbi says, God forbid that that would happen. And that most likely is a metaphor or a didactical passage, which is teaching that all wickedness needs to disappear. And another rabbi says, like a lot of Christians, that it was a special circumstance that this group of people were so wicked that there needed to be exterminated because it was going to be an ongoing thorn on the side of the Israelites. Again, we weren't there. We don't know exactly what happened. Unless they can find some type of archaeological evidence that they came in and they wiped everybody out, it's actually the opposite of what has been found. What has been found is that the people that were there were the same people that came from Egypt, and they were cousins, and they got along somehow, and they mixed DNA. So the narrative is so complicated, so ancient, and so difficult that for us, again, to use a modern day standard of what genocide is, to assume that if a group of people ends up murdering everybody in that community, that it is evil. It's like saying, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki should have never happened. And most people agree to that. But then there's people that justify it because they feel that the war would have gone on and there will be more casualties on both sides. So it's such a moral dilemma that cannot be solved. And then you have a group of so-called scholars and some type of movement that is trying to disprove the deity. They're trying to address a moral issue that is still happening. We still have situations where everybody dies because one group is either paranoid, feels threatened, or does not know what to do in a situation when it gets out of hand. And we're trying to go back in time and trying to make sense of it based on some text that discusses one individual taking on arms and doing things that are harmful. But again, it's something that is out of our reach. So all we can do is take lessons from it and maybe say, well, that I wouldn't do that, or that's not something that goes along with my vision of God. But we can't completely exit all out and say that it is a sign of a illness that all religious people have, and that is that they justify their actions and they do horrible stuff, and then they find a way to claim that that's what God wanted for them. Tony?
Yeah, he's doing a pretty good job at trying to paint a God that he doesn't believe or follow or doesn't even believe exists in a bad light. I got a couple things I wrote down. So first off, you want to make a bet. He didn't even mention the flood, right? Women, men, women, and children died there. Also, I've noticed this a lot amongst a lot of people that are skeptic towards theism. They try to act as if the way they present their arguments, they like to present it in a way as if they're more empathetic than God himself. And so in a way, it's almost saying that they're godly, more godly than God. Another issue I'm seeing is there's not a common thread throughout scripture, as in this so-called deity of evil and mass destruction of genocide goes around and it's just murdering nations left and right. That's non-existent. There's specific context to certain things that was going on. He wants to talk about the Canaanites from Deuteronomy. He fails to mention that the practices of what these people were doing specifically listed in Leviticus. And it is a form of justice. And next we see he has a vendetta. I can see it. He has a vendetta. I see this a lot about atheists, again, people that are skeptics. I appreciate the free thinking, like you said initially in the prologue. It causes people like us to be on our to stay sharp, to always go back and to look at the texts and to reevaluate and things like that. But I still find it lacking in a lot of areas, because he's trying to paint this picture as this God of the Jewish people as being this outright violent and evil God. But we have instances like where a sister was raped in a certain situation, and Simeon and Levi went And they went to go get retribution. And they tricked the men into going and becoming circumcised. And while they were circumcised and they were in a state of vulnerability, they went and slaughtered them. Did God pat him on the back for that? No. God says, because you've done this, the rule and the authority will go to Judah. So they had to submit because of their violence. So it's funny, the God is so violent, then why isn't he rewarding violence? It just doesn't, it's not adding up. And they're painting this picture as if there's just going out and frontier justice everywhere. There's a system. And I can tell the person that is presenting it doesn't know anything about Jewish law and how things are have been handled historically. So he's got holes in it. He's got holes in it. And like you said, you brought up some valid points. We weren't there. We're seeing a summarization of an event that happened that none of us witnessed. And we can only leave it up to our imaginations. So he's it's still not it's not it's not I don't see any valid points yet. I'm still waiting. I'm still waiting for that crystal clear, point he's trying to make.
But the ban is another low point in this documentary, whereas the same people who would consecrate themselves to God, now they're consecrating places for destruction. So there's a judgmental element of, they claim to be holier than thou, and holiness to them is murder. And it's like, again, you're trying to paint us as the crazy cannibals from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That's what you're
Yeah.
trying to do.
I think what he's doing is he has this premise and he's trying to judge the God of the Hebrews as if they're similar religious systems than all the other religions of the world. This is the most Judaism and the God of Israel is such a unique God to all the other gods of mankind. The cities of refuge. I mean, come on, dude. I mean, how compassionate is that? But he's a murderous, rampaging imbecile, right? This is what he's trying to say, but
Well, let's keep going.
As with Deuteronomy 2, 33 through 34, earlier, the ban or dedication results in the dedicated objects or people being utterly destroyed. The rationale for having to kill or exterminate all living things that are placed under the ban has to do with them being set aside or dedicated to Yahweh. Dr. Rossell states, "Its basis is the view that the banned object, which might be a living being, belongs to the divine sphere and is therefore excluded from normal profane utilization or existence. This often means that it must be exterminated. If you set aside something for a deity, then no one else is able to partake of or utilize what has been dedicated. Consider, for example, the idea of sacrifice. The object."
See where he's going? He's doing the same thing that Nietzsche said. Well, Christians serve a weak God that gave his life as a sacrifice, and he was appeasing a wrathful God that was, like bloodthirsty and like a vampire, and he drank Jesus' blood or something like that. That's where he's heading with this harem idea that God was receiving pleasure from murdering all these people. So the monster that he shows in the beginning of the movie is what he's trying to portray God as. So now God is the medieval version of Satan, this monster that eats all the wicked and he gallops them. Like, that's where he's going. And now he's going to make the jump that Jesus took the place of all those people because he was consecrated as the Messiah and he suffered and died. And God was like, cheering on and waiting to swallow him. And like, that's not what Judaism is. This is the caricature based on a poor reading of the New Testament that doesn't even make any sense, and now you're going to pin that on the Jews. It's a Freudian lunacy that Freud got in trouble for, because he was saying that Moses created God No, the Israelites killed Moses, and then they felt bad for it, and they created a god who became the Moses-like figure. And then somebody told him, "So we're not only the murderers of God by killing Christ. Now we're, well," he said, "we're not only the murderers of the Messiah. Now we're the murderers of God." And so he's saying that God is a murderer, and anybody that follows him is a murderer too. And they love destroying and drinking the blood and stuff like that. Just like the comments that you saw on this video, where it just perpetuates anti-Semitism.
Being sacrificed is dedicated or given to the deity for its use. Dr. Gerstenberger explains.
By all rights, the slain animal belongs to the deity, Psalms 50:10. Portions of the harvest and of livestock, indeed, occasionally even one's own children, belong to God, Exodus 22:28 or 29 in English version.
When something is dedicated to the divine sphere, this most often results in that object being killed or destroyed. In the case of people, if you place them under the ban, it precludes or bans anyone else from interacting with or showing mercy to them. Thus, the banned groups or individuals are to be killed. Dr. Van Wilkbos writes,
The verbal root of the word ban means to consecrate or to devote and denotes something or someone that belongs to the deity, Leviticus 27, 28 to 29. In the context of Israel's wars of conquest, it means that what is so devoted is to be entirely destroyed.
When not adhered to completely, this type of dedication carries with it wide-ranging and serious consequences. Consider again the story of Achan from Joshua 7, which was part of our overview of the biblical narrative earlier. Joshua's commands in Joshua 6 stipulate the complete destruction of the city of Jericho and its inhabitants. All the goods that are salvaged from the ruins, including valuables like silver, gold, iron, and bronze, are to be brought into the house of Yahweh and likewise dedicated to him. We see in chapter 7 that a certain man named Achan violated the command and took a few things from the city, hiding them under his tent. This brought severe judgment upon Achan, his family, and even the nation because of this one act of defilement. When something is dedicated to Yahweh, there are no half measures. A thing cannot be partially dedicated to a god. Significant passages of violence.
So, a thief is now the hero. So, we're gonna go all kinds, like, again, if the victors are the ones writing the story, you could take the idea that all the bad guys in the Bible were the good guys. And yeah, I'm a big fan of Bauer, it's like Bauer, who said that all the heretics in Christianity were actually the real Christians, and all the institutionalized Christians were the fake ones. So I'll give him that. Okay, fine. Goliath was the good guy, and the Egyptians were mistreated by the Hebrews or whatever. And that's what Christian Bale said about Moses when he portrayed him, that Moses was a terrorist, and he was he murdered the firstborn son after kidnapping him, and he held the Egyptian kingdom hostage to his whims. Fine, let's be creative with the text. Let's just throw everything out and reconstruct it from scratch. I want to see how he does that with the significant passages of violence and genocide. If we're gonna get nuts, let's get nuts, like Michael Keaton would say in Batman.
And genocide. As you can imagine, in a documentary like this, there's no way that we can cover all the various passages that describe divine violence and genocide. However, I would like to go through several significant passages, particularly in the books of Deuteronomy and Joshua, that prominently feature some of the most problematic, violent divine commands in the Hebrew Bible. Later in the video, we will extend our investigation to other violent texts in the Old and New Testaments. But the passages examined here will lay the groundwork for what is to come. We will focus on Deuteronomy 7, several passages in the book of Joshua and 1 Samuel 15, Deuteronomy 7, a call for destruction.
When Yahweh your God brings you to the land that you are about to enter to possess, and he drives out many nations from before you, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you, and Yahweh your God hands them over to you, and you strike them down, you must absolutely destroy them. Do not make a covenant with them, and do not show them any mercy. Deuteronomy 7:1-2.
We have already seen sections of Deuteronomy 2 and 3 that describe the ban that was inflicted upon Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, in Transjordan. Moses admonishes the
both mythological giants. Let's talk about that. So now, if we're going to look at metaphors and legends, you have giants. They're killing giants, and they're killing the people who follow the giants. So if you're going to get silly and start questioning everything, maybe that's a metaphor, because Giborim in Hebrew means mighty ones. But the way that a lot of people interpret it is that Og and the other guy were giants. So why don't you talk about that? They killed monsters. So I wonder how this guy interprets Leviathan and what's the other monster?
Behemoth.
Behemoth.
Children of Israel to keep the law. For Yahweh and not worship other gods, for those who forsake Yahweh will themselves be destroyed. Deuteronomy 7:10. For the children of Israel, the great danger of falling into rebellion by worshiping other gods was exacerbated by the continued presence of foreigners in the land surrounding them. Notice verses 3-4.
And you shall not marry them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor shall you take their daughter for your son. Because they will turn your son away from me, and they will serve other gods. And the fierce anger of Yahweh will burn against you, and he will destroy you quickly. Deuteronomy 7:3-4.
I'm waiting for him to call the Israelites racist. Maybe you're more familiar with all the wives that Moses had, but weren't at least one of them from a different tribe and from a different people?
Yeah.
So this idea of what Daniel Boyarin would claim is tribalism and almost some type of racism, it's ignorant, because to ask for your children not to participate in temple prostitution or to sacrificial stuff that is not allowed, such as killing humans, is not a form of racism. It's a form of trying to keep people from doing bad stuff, like morality. But
yeah, more like cultural purity.
Yeah, so you can say they were obsessed with purity, that's fine, but you can't say that they were being discriminatory in a negative way. They were being discriminatory in a positive way, trying to stay away from corruption. So I'm sure that it, somewhere in here is going to get in there. You already threw in genocide, which is a modern term. So again, it's very easy to judge ancient texts with modern day values.
In verse 16, we read,
and you will destroy all the peoples that Yahweh your God is about to deliver to you. Your eyes shall not look compassionately on them, and you shall not serve their gods, because that will be a snare for you. Deuteronomy 7:16.
We see here that both negative and positive commands were given to the Israelites. Negatively, they were to keep from intermingling with the native residents and were to show no pity on them. As for the positive command, they were to absolutely destroy them, along with all the cultic paraphernalia in the land. The point was that they were to maintain their absolute purity by removing all things that might tempt them to fall into worshiping other deities. Dr. Craigie summarizes the policy of eradication in Canaan this way.
When the Israelites conquered their new land, they were to destroy the old inhabitants, refusing to enter into any kind of treaty with them, either political or marital. Any kind of treaty would be a compromise and would lead to disaster. Therefore, the Israelites were to destroy systematically the physical religious furniture of their enemies, indicating thereby their complete lack of recognition for the gods of their enemies.
Toward the end of the book of Joshua, after Yahweh had defeated and driven out Israel's enemies from the land of Canaan, a similar command is reiterated to the people.
Now take great heed to yourselves to love Yahweh, your God. Because if you, in fact, go back and cling to the remnant of these nations, these that remain with you, and you intermarry with them, and you go into them and they into you, you must surely know that Yahweh, your God, will no longer drive out these nations from before you, and they will be to you as a trap and a snare, and as scourges against your sides and as thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off this good land that Yahweh, your God, has given to you. Joshua 23:12-13.
Notice the emphasis on maintaining separation from foreign influence, as it would ensnare the Israelites to fall into idol worship, leading them to suffer the consequences of Yahweh's wrath. Dr. Tige summarizes.
The reason for the severe treatment of the Canaanites is to prevent the Israelites from intermarrying with them and being lured into the worship of their gods in violation of the first two commandments. The experience at Peor, recorded in Numbers 25:1-3, had already shown how sexual attraction leads to worship of foreign gods.
This reference to the incident at Peor is one that the reader is likely familiar with. The Israelites were seduced by foreign women, which brought the wrath of Yahweh upon them. It is this same principle that operates in Deuteronomy 7. If the Canaanites are left to remain in the land, they will become a snare to the Israelites, cause them to worship other gods, and thereby incur Yahweh's wrath.
So Mr. Derek just gave us the whole point of Joshua and all these passages is, hey, do not contaminate yourselves with deities like you did in Egypt. And deities from the foreign worship are destructive, just like in Judaism, idolatry, murder, and sexual sin are unforgivable sins. They're saying do not partake of those things that are destructive. So just a quick Google reference about the difference between Joshua and Judges. It says, while Joshua describes the successes of the Israelites in their conquest, Judges provides a more nuanced and complex understanding of the events. It describes the difficulties and struggles that the Israelites faced in their attempt to conquer the land, including their continued need to battle against the Canaanite inhabitants and other nations that threatened their presence. Furthermore, Judges also highlights the way that the Israelites were impacted by their new environment, such as the way they often adopted Canaanite customs and beliefs. Thus, by reading both books, readers are able to gain a more complex understanding of the complexities of the conquest and the various ways it impacted the lives of the Israelites. So in my interview with John Dominic Crossan, he said that Joshua is like a retelling of what really happened that puts the Israelites in a positive light. And back then, destroying your enemies was a virtue. You were seen as weak if you didn't destroy your enemies and wipe them all out. But in Judges, you see that they didn't do that. They made deals. They struggled. A lot of them fell into those practices. So a more sanitized version is depicted in, and that's the only one that this author and this presenter are showing. So they don't even know that there's layers and that there's two versions. They're just focused on what's going to make the Israelites look like maniac murderers. And that's what they're presenting to the public.
For this reason, they must be eradicated. Deuteronomy. Therapy, for me, came at a time that was really pivotal. Becoming a new father, I needed more.
We're about to get kicked out again.
Rules of engagement. In Deuteronomy 20, we have a detailed set of rules of engagement by which Israel is to operate. The targets of Israel's military aggression are divided into two groups, those cities inside the land of Canaan and those that lie outside. Each group is to be engaged in a distinct manner.
When you draw near to a city to do battle against it, you are to proclaim to it an offer of peace. And it will be that if it, the city, answers you peacefully and it opens up to you, then it will be that all the people that are found inside will be available to you as forced labor and they will serve you. But if it will not make peace with you and makes war with you, then you shall besiege it, and Yahweh your God will deliver it into your hand. And you shall strike down all its males with the edge of the sword. But the women and the young children and the beasts and all that is in the city, all its spoil, you will take as plunder for yourselves, and you will consume the spoil of your enemies, whom Yahweh your God has given to you. Thus you will do to all the cities that are very far away from you, which are not from among the cities of these nations, in Canaan. Deuteronomy 20:10-15.
Here the text is speaking exclusively of those cities that are far off. We are not dealing with the Canaanite cities of the promised land. These will fall under a different set of rules in the following verses. The plan was that Israel would trust and obey Yahweh, take Canaan, and then expand outward, extending their dominion far outside Israel's borders. It is these cities with which the text is concerned here. Dr. Lundbaum explains.
The warfare envisioned is like what occurred under David when battles were fought outside Canaan proper, 2 Sam 10:19, or what could have occurred if the conquest had taken in all the land originally promised, like Philistia, Lebanon, and Aram, Syria, east to the Euphrates.
What was the procedure? The Israelite army was to approach each city outside the land and offer it the chance to make what amounts to a full surrender, an offer of peace, shalom. Dr. Nelson writes,
Verse 10 is not so much a diplomatic proposal of peace as a non-negotiable demand for submission. There are only two possible alternative consequences, capitulation or siege.
These two options, of course, do not present a choice between a good and a bad situation for the city, but rather choosing between two bad options. On the one hand, the foreign city could surrender, in which case they would become a vassal state, subject to forced or corvée labor, Hebrew mas. Dr. Lundbaum describes the type of forced labor.
This would be task work in agriculture and construction projects such as David, required of the Ammonites, whom Psalm 12:31, and Solomon, required of Canaanites who had not been expelled from the land, 1 Kings 9:15-21, cf. Judges 1:27-35. The Gibeonite became hewers of wood and drawers of water, Joshua 9:21-27.
Should they refuse?
So was it a botched job because they were supposed to kill the Canaanites? So why is Solomon using them for laborers? So they did a terrible slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it gets funky. And, you know, this is the Torah. So this is a huge challenge for us Jews, that the Torah is telling people to, you know, murder some, keep other, use the women and the children for your spoil. So this is tough. So I'll give it to them. It is difficult stuff, but let's see where else he's going with it.
To surrender, to be subjected to forced labor, the Israelites would lay siege, gain entry to the city, and kill all the men. They would then take the women, small children, animals, and anything else of value as plunder. The men in the city likely represented the fighting force, and none were to be left alive. The anachronistic idea of taking prisoners of war is not found in texts. The enemy combatants are not spared. Anyone left alive in these imagined conquests now belong to the Israelites. In short, for cities outside the land of Canaan, the offer was vassalage or destruction. But what about the cities that were inside Canaan? A different fate awaited them.
Let's say imagine conquest. So he's acknowledging that this is projected or reworked to make it seem like the Israelites were that powerful. Again, these were the descendants of a tribe of slaves who were living in the desert for 40 years. Where did they get the military ability to be able to do all this? It gives the impression that God made them great warriors, but in the text it shows that they were kind of weak and scared. They thought their enemies were too formidable for them to take. So now he's kind of like, you know, struggling because he knows that it's a lot for them to achieve, to destroy all these people and take them over. So again, if you hear from a general that when they went to Iraq, they took over and now everybody's free and stuff like that. You know that's not true. You know that it was a horrible experience for everyone, but in hindsight, he can give you the highlights and say that everything went great. So there could be some of that going on. Again, because he's dealing with the Torah, not just with the judges and the prophets, it's a little harder for us to make a case. As Asher Mesa would say, you don't mess with the Torah. The Torah has more weight. So now we have to use interpretive methods, and like I was saying earlier, mitigate these ideas to make them make sense, because there's a point where even logically, how were they able to achieve this unless it was miraculous? And then if it was miraculous, then it becomes a cyclical argument, because then it's like, well, if God gave them the power to do that, then it was meant to happen, and the people there, deserved it and stuff like that. And that's, I think, what the atheist movement has issues with, is that it's a narrative that doesn't make sense for the modern man, and I can see that.
However, from the cities of these peoples, whom Yahweh your God is about to give to you as an inheritance, you must not leave anything alive that breathes. You must certainly completely destroy them, the Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, just as Yahweh your God has commanded you, so that they will not teach you to do according to all their abominations, which they have done for their gods, leading you so sin against Yahweh your God. Deuteronomy 20:16-18.
There was to be no offer of peace. Nope.
Tony, tell us about the concept of sin in Judaism, because that's something that we've been discussing with a friend of ours, and it is a huge element that cannot be ignored. Christians talk about sin as disappointing God and being naughty or not meeting the mark. What is sin in Judaism?
Violation of God's holy Torah.
Okay, so the instructions of God are a certain behavior that is virtuous, and then when you are not able to achieve it, that would be an avera. Okay, so Christians would portray that nothing you do is worthwhile, and that God is angry at you, and that you have to find somebody to intercede on your behalf. It's like a courtroom. In Judaism, it's almost like disappointing your father or mother. Like, God expects more from you. You have a unique role from the get-go, versus nothing you do is ever worthwhile. So when they say that mixing with these other groups leads to disobeying God, they have a moral system that is already there. And if you compare it to the Sumerian and Babylonian codes, they're very similar. The king makes a covenant with the people, and the people behave on their rules. So this is the birth of civilization. So to say that the people who created civilization are at fault for wanting to keep civilization alive is almost like in The Walking Dead, where they had to make choices and work out how are they going to implement these rules. And sometimes there was caveats. It wasn't always the same. So if you see in the later seasons of The Walking Dead, they have to decide if to put someone to death is the way to deal with their wickedness. They have to decide if having a court system with all the different towns is going to be the way to deal with rebellious individuals who are still wanting to bring destruction. They have to decide how to deal with natural issues that come their way. In their version, the plague is the zombies, and this one it would be diseases and other natural phenomena. So all that is taking place. Sometimes it's brutal, and sometimes it's exchange of the making a deal with the people there. But it's almost like a working of how do you keep civilization alive. So if you come and you see it as this barbarous people, then you miss that element that it is being conveyed in the text.
Yeah, I think what's going on is it's not understanding that the relationship that Hashem has with his people is likened unto a father. And when you disappoint God, aka sin, you've missed the mark, but there's always an opportunity to make things right. But it's like, this is why the fear of the Lord is supposed to be always with us, because it's not the fear as in, ooh, scary, evil God. No, it's the fear of me as a human being not being perfect. I should have that fear that my actions can tarnish my relationship with my Father in heaven. And so this is why we have the fear, so that we can always keep our eyes focused on doing what's right and being kind and loving and merciful. I mean, I can see his dilemma, like you said, the progression of the modern man compared to we're talking about 3,000 years ago, 3,500 years ago, and like societies were brutally violent. All societies. I mean, all you have to do is just take your bias lenses off and just go study some history. The nations didn't need God to do all these things. Murder, rape, incest, all these things. They didn't need God for that. They did that on their own. And so you were dealing with, even though the Jewish people are God's people, they're still not perfect people. And this is what people don't understand. We see this development. Now you look at Israel in its infancy when they're called out of Egypt. Look at them today. Look what God transformed them into. Because what's being conveyed here is there's this evil God that's wrathful of vengeance. It wants murder. There's a situation going on in Israel right now with real terrorists, real evil. And Israel's going by the books. Like the way he's painting the picture of the way God's commanding Israel to do things, there would be no such thing as Palestine. There would be no such thing as the West Bank. There wouldn't be. I'm still waiting for this crystal clear image to paint that God is evil and unjust. Well, how far are we in? 30 minutes in. 30 minutes in. I know we still have, an hour and a half left, but...
But let's take a very progressive approach. If you believe in progressive revelation, that God has been showing a little bit more and a little bit more of him throughout the years, this is the infancy of religion. So the infancy of religion is going to be messy. And like you said, not to justify, genocide, as they would put it, there was all kinds of slaughtering and horrible stuff going on all the time. And now you have a group of people who are within that system making small strides in the right direction. That would be the half full perspective of the glass. But if you have a half empty, then you're like, these people are perpetuating the wickedness that was in the land. So you agree that it's wicked for everybody to slaughter each other. So your own sense of justice is being questioned at this time. So I have respect for that and what the atheist movement is doing. But again, it's the incrementalism is what they really have a problem with. That it took years for them to realize that you shouldn't murder everyone. When God in the life of Solomon tells David that he's not allowed to build a temple because he has blood in his hands, that is a development. Suddenly, the same deity that told him to go destroy his own enemies and help them through it, now he's saying, that's not how I wanted to go on. I need someone with pure hands and a merciful spirit to be the next king. And then Solomon did other things that were naughty in a different way. So, but they're always being held accountable. So there is that element. If there was no accountability, then the stories would be purposeless. So you have to always look at what are they trying to convey? and what's the ultimate message? Because if the message is God wanted you to kill all these people so you could win power over them, then why is he always knocking them down? Like you said, if they did the job properly, then they would be the conquerors of the whole earth. But there's this sense of guilt and shame and judgment that keeps coming back. So there's something wrong, either the way they're going about it, how they're communicating it, or how they're living it out. So there's this constant push and pull that happens in the text. And that's what we as human beings experience all the time as well. So making a very shallow version of the story and then trying to knock it over, it's a typical tactic that is done by people who are not being fair when they're dealing with individuals or ancient civilizations.
Opportunity for forced labor, not even the chance for women and children to be spared as plunder. Everyone was to certainly be destroyed. Again, following the logic of the earlier passage in Deuteronomy 7, and in keeping with what we will see coming throughout the book of Joshua, the rationale is clear. To leave a remnant of outsiders in the land where Israel is dwelling would leave open the possibility for temptation to fall into idolatry and be destroyed by Yahweh. Other well-known divine commands for violence and genocide come from the book of Joshua. As the Israelites take the land of Canaan in the conquest, the book opens with Yahweh commanding Joshua,
"Moses, my servant, is dead. Now get up, cross over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I'm about to give to them, to the children of Israel. Every place where the sole of your foot will tread, to you have I given it, just as I said to Moses." Joshua 1, 2, 3.
The command to enforce the ban continued under Joshua. Standing before the city of Jericho, ready to watch it fall, he cried,
"Now the city will be dedicated to destruction, it and all that is in it, to Yahweh. Only Rahab will live, she and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent." Joshua 6:17.
In fact, throughout the book of Joshua, the Israelites go from site to site, completely destroying various cities by the command of Yahweh. We get several summary statements in the book concerning the defeat that Israel inflicts upon their adversaries.
"So Joshua struck down all the land, the mountain and the Negev and the Shephelah and the slopes and all their kings. He did not leave anyone who escaped, but he completely destroyed all who breathed, just as Yahweh, the God of Israel, had commanded." Joshua 10:40.
And again,
"And all the cities of these kings and all their kings, Joshua captured and struck them down with the edge of the sword. He completely destroyed them, just as Moses, the servant of Yahweh, had commanded." Joshua 11:12.
there is no question from the text that the command of Yahweh was to enforce the ban upon all the Canaanites, just as we saw in the book of Deuteronomy. While Yahweh's instructions are clear, the Israelites failed to carry out these orders in full. Following the conquest narrative in Joshua 1 through 12, chapter 13 opens with Joshua as an old man to whom Yahweh appears.
"And Yahweh said to him, 'You are old and advanced in years, but a great deal of land remains to be possessed.'" Joshua 13:1.
The command that was given for the nation of Israel to possess the land has not been fulfilled completely. Here, much of the land is yet to be possessed. Is this considered to be a good thing in the narrative? Do we see the author presenting this in a positive light? Is the idea, "Oh, good. In a show of mercy, they must have spared such and such people groups in the land from destruction"? No. Instead, this is seen as a failure on the part of the nation of Israel, a theme that continues into the book of Judges.
In chapter 1, the message was an encouragement to conquer the land. In chapter 13, the emphasis is on the land not yet conquered.
Dr. Collins comes more to the point.
The book of Joshua claims that Joshua carried out a campaign of wholesale slaughter. For this, he is not faulted. On the contrary, the Israelites are blamed for falling short of total slaughter and failing to drive out all the Canaanites. Joshua 13:13, Judges 1.
That this was considered a failure clearly shows that the prior commands were not intended to be taken as hyperbole. They are instructions to literally eradicate whole cities. If it were hyperbolic language, then the fact that a great deal of the land had not yet been subjected to this treatment would pose no issue. 1 Samuel 15, the Amalekites. The final passage that we will evaluate in this section is 1 Samuel 15. While we will return to this narrative at length later in this documentary, it is an important passage to overview in the present context. If you recall from earlier in this documentary, Samuel comes to Saul and commands him to go and kill the Amalekites because of what they did to the Israelites when they were coming up out of Egypt. The extent to which Saul is to completely destroy Horam, the Amalekites, reaches
from man to woman, from child to infant, from bull to lamb, from camel to donkey, 1 Samuel 15:3b.
This is language of complete, wholesale destruction, echoes that which we have already seen in the books of Deuteronomy and Joshua. As before, the calls for the annihilation of Amalek and its people, cattle, etc., employs a form of the same word, harim, we touched on above. Interestingly, the writer is at pains to point out that while Saul attacks the Amalekites as instructed, he also warns a group known as the Kenites to flee the area. The mercy shown to the Kenites is in return for kindness they showed Israel on their way out of Egypt. This incident is nowhere mentioned in the stories of the Exodus and Israel's wilderness wanderings. So why am I mentioning the Kenites in this context? It is because they represent yet another example of the totality of the ban. The Kenites appear to have been associated with the Amalekites to some degree, even living in the same settlements. Given the Kenites' close proximity to and possible association with the Amalekites, coupled with the all-encompassing nature of the ban, we might expect the Kenites to be annihilated along with the Amalekites. This act of mercy was the great exception to the all-encompassing nature of the ban. As we will see later in this documentary, this theme of an exception to the total nature of the ban, often based on the faithfulness of the exempted party, appears in several places throughout the Old Testament. If this command of destruction were intended to be hyperbolic, why note that a specific group of people was spared? Hyperbole assumes that some people will be shown mercy. Pointing out that a specific group was spared from slaughter is redundant. The command to save the Kenites from the ban is only noteworthy because it goes against the all-encompassing nature of the instruction to destroy the Amalekites. The writer is showing that the requirement to completely destroy meant exactly that, the complete destruction of everyone.
Come on, man. If you make a zero-sum approach where it's either literal or metaphorical, and you say metaphors are only one-sided, like you say something and it has to be that way, then there's no didactical purpose. If it's showing that you can show mercy, then it's not a complete ban. There's caveats. There's a way to go about around the command. If your dad tells you, go clean the garage, and then he comes in and there's still some boxes, and then you say, well, I decided to keep aside dirty because I was tired. If your dad is a despot, he would hurt you for not following the rule. But if your dad is a cool guy, he would say, okay, baby, I trust your judgment. So how can it be a complete, you know, utter ban that leads to destruction, and then they make concessions? So then you're not learning anything from that passage. The passage is supposed to be, even in the midst of following the rules, if there are people who are willing to change and they're willing to show love and compassion, you show love and compassion to them. So the purpose, didactical purpose of that story is that the wicked deserve no mercy. Not the righteous. If there was no religious message conveyed, it would be murder everyone. But the message is that there are good people, just like Sodom and Gomorrah. He says, if there is a righteous person, you spare them. So there is very special message that it's trying to be conveyed in relation to judging people according to their works, according to their virtues, if it's just we murdered them because they're all caught up in this systematic destruction of the area so you can occupy it or take it over, then there wouldn't be any possibilities for anybody to survive. So you lose this argument very easily if you add a third component. You're saying metaphor is not a thing, literalism is a thing. The third component is didactical, because that's how you teach people not only to behave, but to find the good and the evil. And writing people off as wicked is what it keeps doing throughout all the different texts that you quote, saying there's a kind of wickedness that has to be exterminated. But if there are people among them who change and are willing to have an amicable relationship and they show mercy to us, we will show mercy to them. So that's an honorable thing that they're doing, not this mass slaughter that they're being accused of. What do you think, Tony?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a you see this development going on, and the whole moral of the whole thing is like you said, it's to teach people how to behave. When you have, let's say, you put somebody, Hashem put somebody under a ban. And then it says because of the abominations that they were practicing. Okay, well, you have to think, well, what are these abominations? And then you have to say, well, okay, well, of course, it can't be all of them, or is it all of them? And then you have to ask yourself, well, is there any more information to this? So I think he's picking and choosing what he wants to adhere to. And he's doing a very good job of painting a picture for his audience, and it's not concise, and it's not thorough. It's got too many holes in it. And the very God he's talking about commands righteousness and justice for all. I'm just curious to
And
see where he keeps
everything,
going with
from
this.
man to woman, from child to infant, from bull to lamb, from camel to donkey. 1 Samuel 15:3. In the end, Saul carries out his task, but with more exceptions than allowed by Yahweh. His fault lies not in taking a hyperbolic command literally, but rather in taking the extent of a literal command as something less. Saul chooses not to execute the king, and he spares some of the choice animals. For this, he is not only scolded by the prophet, but is ultimately rejected by Yahweh as king of Israel, 1 Samuel 15:23. In fact, because Saul fails to carry out the total slaughter of everyone, including the king, Samuel is forced to take out his own weapon and kill the Amalekite ruler. The finer points in this narrative make abundantly clear the ban required the complete annihilation of all those who had been dedicated to destruction. Sparing but one individual and a few animals was deemed a failure to carry out its proper execution. If this were hyperbolic language, these few exceptions would have been expected. Looking back on these several passages in Deuteronomy, Joshua, and 1 Samuel, we could see a pattern of themes and consistencies that run throughout. First, the use of the noun harem, ban, and the verb haram, to destroy, repeatedly appear in these texts. In each case, they are part of a divine mandate to devote a particular city or people group to Yahweh for destruction. Second, whatever the historical reality, the narratives call for the complete execution of the ban. Once something is dedicated to Yahweh, it is completely dedicated. As we have seen in 1 Samuel 15, and as we will see greater in detail, the narrative hinges upon the total execution of the ban. In the example of 1 Samuel 15, because Saul spared even a small remnant of the Amalekites, his task was considered a failure. Apologetic defenses of divine violence and genocide. What do Christians and apologists say about these types of divine commands that call for violence and genocide in the Old Testament? What defenses or justifications are put forward to get God off the hook, as it were? For the most part, I tend to read and hear two general types of arguments to explain or defend the biblical texts. One, God was justified in his actions, and two, these passages are hyperbolic. We will examine both of these positions in this section, evaluating their strengths and weaknesses, along with the ramifications that accompany adherence to these interpretations of the text. The most frequent response I see from those seeking to defend the violent actions of Yahweh in the Old Testament is to argue that God was completely justified in bringing judgment upon the victims. Yes, Yahweh acted with great violence, either directly or indirectly, but this was not arbitrary or malicious. Rather, it was an enactment of perfect divine justice against rebellious and incredibly wicked groups of people. There are several very common examples of the causes and effects of such divine retribution that adherents will point to, including, for example, the worldwide flood of Genesis 6 through 9. And he wiped out every living thing which was upon the ground, from man to beast to creeping thing, and to the birds of heaven. And they were wiped out from the earth, and only Noah and those with him in the ark remain. Genesis 7 to 23. The extermination of all but 8 humans and 2 of each species of animal will rightly draw strong criticism from many readers of the story. Of course, the text does not lead us to conclude that Yahweh was in any way unjustified in bringing about this devastating deluge. And Yahweh saw that great was the wickedness of humanity in the earth, and every intent of the thoughts of his heart are only evil continually. Genesis 6:5. The passage itself explicitly validates the violent actions of the deity. This explanation, that the entire world was completely corrupt and sinful, might not hold up under scrutiny for a more fundamentalist interpretation of the story. What of the infants who were not capable of knowing or doing evil? All told, this is not the point of the text. Other biblical narratives do not seem to go to such lengths to justify Yahweh's act.
What are we, children? Like, I just don't understand how can someone bring up a passage like that and not use any of the tools that we have as modern men. If you look at all the myths where they all mention floods or some type of natural disaster, nobody's worried about the people that died. They're worried about, is this going to happen again? Or this is an ongoing thing. We have monsoons, we have tornadoes, we have all kinds of stuff that comes our way. And to be so, oh my goodness, what kind of guy would do that? Again, you're fighting nature. You're fighting the cosmos. You're not fighting the particular vision of God from this group of people. You're acting like, I want all human beings that ever existed to be here because it's cruel for anybody to die at any point. Like, you can't see it as people die. We don't know how to explain it. Sometimes they die in catastrophic ways, and some people survive. Maybe they're special. Maybe they have a purpose. Like, let's make the story a legend. You know, I'm not going to debate anybody about it happened or it didn't happen, but let's say that it is a legend. It's a legend that it is to the point. Horrible stuff is going on. Something happened. So I can see primitive man saying there's a reason why things happen, and it must be our behavior. And then there's a group of people who did the right thing and they survived. So as a survivalist, you could say the people that packed up their lunch and had rations survived, and the people that didn't care, the wave took them. Okay, I'm not gonna, you know, fight you over, did it really happen? Was it the whole world? Was it just a small area? To them, it was. To them, it was catastrophic and divine. Like, now you're going to be debating over children that we didn't even know if they were there or not. And then, well, what about the whales? Did the whales die because they were in the water? And what about the dinosaurs? Like, come on, man. This is childish debates. Like, you're building a case against the deity from a particular group that didn't even exist at that time. And you're going back another 6,000 years, whatever, to a story that is very simple. There's nothing to fight about. and it's all or nothing. Star Wars is good and bad. There's nothing, there's no in between. How can you make that your main element? Now at 41 minutes, I'm gonna bring down the house with how cruel he was from the beginning by killing all the babies.
I think it's the opposite when you think about, I guess, his position, what he's trying to bring to the table. It's unjust to allow humanity to completely stay in a state of mind where they're self-destructive and they're practicing all types of moral depravities. I mean, what's the point of that world, that type of world, without intervening and stopping it? And then not just that, but if you stand on the edge of a curb, which is what, maybe 6 inches, not even 6 inches, 4 inches to the ground, you'll be careless. But now if that drop is plunging to your death, you'll be more careful to stay away from that edge. So when there's consequence for our actions, human beings tend to be more act in more moral and ethical ways. And we see this today. You've got the laws of the land. There's a punishment for this crime, therefore we don't do this. But in the times where this stuff is going on, there is no police, there is no governments, there is no militaries in the modern sense. These people are living in a primitive way compared to what we live today. So, yeah.
Well, we have 5 more minutes and then we're going to call it a night, but
Nevertheless, many of these generally imply some rationalizations given for God's commands, although they rarely meet our modern standards of moral justification for the violence inflicted upon the victims. By way of example, let's use the case of the Canaanites in the conquest of Joshua. We saw before that the book of Joshua describes the conquest of the land of Canaan by the Israelites at the direction of Yahweh. What rationale does the Old Testament give for the eradication or dispossession of the indigenous population of Canaan? Most commentators would see Yahweh's justification in commanding such violence in the wickedness and rebellion of the Canaanites. Let's take a look at a passage from early in the story that lays the groundwork for the Israelite conquest in Genesis 15.
And he said to Abram, "Know for sure that your descendants will be resident aliens in a land that is not their own, and they will serve them, and they will oppress them for 400 years. And also that nation whom they serve will I myself judge, and afterwards they will go out with great possessions. And you yourself will go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. And in the fourth generation they will return here, since the wickedness of the Amorites is not complete yet." Genesis 15:13-16.
There are several things to notice in this passage. If you read through the context, you will see that Abram has been promised descendants, so many descendants that he will be unable to count them. Now, Abram is pretty old, as is Sarai, his wife. How will Abram know that all this will actually come to pass? Yahweh has him perform a ritual by which they might ratify this agreement or covenant sworn between two parties. Before the ritual is performed, Yahweh describes what is going to happen to Abram and his descendants in the future. They are going to serve another nation for a lengthy period of time and eventually return to the land promised by Yahweh to Abram, where he has presently settled. But why such a lengthy period of time? Why not give him the land then and there? Certainly, Abram could establish his family and begin to put down roots, which would ultimately result in the vast number of descendants that Yahweh had promised. However, this was not God's plan. Yahweh had determined that the inhabitants of the land had not yet become wicked enough to bring about his wrath. Dr. Goldengay says it this way:
Yahweh cannot simply throw out the current inhabitants of the country in favor of Abraham's offspring, whom he wishes to favor, even for the sake of his own purpose for the world as a whole. The Amorites must and will have lots of time to turn from their waywardness before Yahweh will be able to say, "That's it."
It's a name that often simply designates people that live in the land of Canaan who cannot receive retribution prematurely. Dr. Winham agrees.
Here the Amorites stand for all the inhabitants of Canaan. Divine judgment in the form of Israel's conquest must wait until they are sufficiently wicked to deserve this fate.
Similarly, Dr. Hamilton summarizes,
Only when the iniquity of the Amorites, like the pre-Israelite inhabitants of Palestine, has run its full measure, will the Israelites enter Palestine to claim it and possess it. Only when the iniquity of the Amorites has reached the point of no return will they forfeit the land.
Who's this doctor, whatever, using anachronistic terms like Palestine is another ridiculous example of how we know where this is going. Palestine did not become Palestine until 150 or 60 AD, when the Romans, to make fun of the Jews who they destroyed in the second revolt and kicked them out of the land, named it after the Philistines. So to say the pre-Israelite inhabitants of Palestine, and then they enter into Palestine to claim possession, it's a political tactic to try to equate the Arabs in modern Palestine, which existed until 1948, and the modern Israelis since then, in the last 75 years, to push an agenda. And the same author or presenter had Dr. Carter do the same thing, talk about Palestine this and Palestine that. So now we're dealing with their true politics are being exhibited. And it's funny, as Tony was saying, there hasn't been any discussion of the God of Islam and how the God of Islam views conquering lands and taking over places. So it's funny that we beat up on the Hebrew version of God and maybe the Christian version of God, but the God of Islam is never discussed in this show. And then how it focuses on a lot of these elements that they would consider destructive and abusive, and pushes them forward to medieval times and the modern era.